Thanks a lot for the invitation to the conference and to ATMUFO as well. And it's a great pleasure to be here, and also I'm really looking forward to these 2 days of discussion. What I'm going to try to do today is to look back into what is called the Europe refugee crisis and try to unpack one that I think is one of the focal points around which a lot of the discourse, narrative and policies have been constructed, which is death. Is the migrants' dead bodies and how they have been mourned officially and unofficially is a central tenet of the way that we have understood what was going on, in particular since 2013. I'm basing my this paper, this presentation, on the data that were collected as part of the MedMIG project, unraveling the Europe Mediterranean Migration Crisis project funded by the Economic and Social Research Council in 2015 and 16. So the main sort of a question I'm trying to reflect with you today is how have these dead bodies impact on the EU response to the refugee crisis? Who does cry and claim whom? But also, do all bodies count the same? And finally, in what way the absence of invisibilization of these bodies may impact on the Europe response to boat migration. In many ways, the recent development very much, and we can discuss at the end, but the very, very much answer to this third point. So as Sari was mentioning, we got a forthcoming book based on this project that is coming out in December and is co-authored with Evan Crowley, Frank Duell, Catherine Jones, Simon McMahon. It's going to be published by Policy Press. The MedMIG project lasted about 13, 14 months between September 2015 and November 2016. And in this period, we carried out 500 interviews, structured interviews with refugee and migrants who had just arrived in the last 12 months in Italy, Turkey, Greece, and Malta. And about 100 interviews with stakeholders, including from volunteers to ministers in these four locations. If you want to find out more about the project, you can look at menmig.info, where you can find also the final report of the project, where you got a more extensive coverage of the number of issues that we have unpacked with this research. Here, this is an illustration of where the people that we interviewed were coming from and where the interview was carried out. So the blue dot is the starting point of their journey. However, the word journey will need to be unpacked as well, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do it today. And the red dot is the location in which the interview was carried out. As you can see, in the case of Italy in particular, interviews were carried out in a number of locations, both at the point of entry, so mostly in Sicily, Puglia, and Calabria, but also in transit area, mostly Rome, Milan, but also in Piedmont. In the case of Greece, a lot of the interviews were carried out on the islands and in Thessaloniki and Athens. The way that the selection of the place where the interviews had to be carried out were very much shaped by the different natures of the flows we were trying to capture. So just to give you an example, if you look at the data about arrival disembarkation in Italy in 2015, you will see that two of the largest groups, in 2014 in particular, two of the largest groups were Sudanese and Syrians. However, if you look at the data on asylum application in Italy for the same years, these groups are basically invisible. So this means that if we were only doing interviews in reception centers where people get a fingerprint and identified, you would not interview Syrians or Sudanese because they were not there. And instead, we had to do the interviews, for example, in train stations in Milan and Rome, where people were transiting through towards Northern Europe. So that was why the strategies of carrying out the interview had to be shaped according to these different trajectories. So just to give you a sense of the way that I'm planning to unpack the discussion around death and the politics of mourning. So I want to just give you a few very sort of key facts and figures around the refugee crisis. And in other presentation, I tend to very much unpack them, but for now I'll give you as a more or less without inverted commas around them. Then I'll try to look into which migrant bodies count and don't count, and why, in the way that they have been officially mourned, and also understand to what extent the way that we have cried those bodies has affected the responses to arrivals. In the second part, he said, I'll turn to the interviews with migrants and refugees that we carried out to look instead to how death and violence is experienced from the perspective of the people we interviewed. And as you will see, there is a hiatus, a non-connection between, on one end, the perception of death in the public discourse on the refugee crisis and the way that death was understood and constructed and responded to by the people we interviewed. And sort of in this space, I think that there is some work to be done, and I hope to raise questions around it. So the crisis in numbers. So and looking at the period between 2014 and 16, because it's mostly a period that we covered with the research, but also it's what we would call it the peak of the refugee crisis and of its evolution. I'm happy to answer a question later on about the 2017 as well, but in a sense, it doesn't necessarily add much at the story, or the idea, the understanding of the story of the crisis. Over 1.6 million people crossed the Mediterranean to Europe between 2014 and 2016. And about 12,000 people were dead and missing in the Mediterranean over the same period of time. If you look at the 2015 alone, and in a sense, this year, when we did the research, we didn't know that that was an exceptional year. But now you can look at the back, and it's clearly was unprecedented and hasn't been. We haven't seen the same numbers in the following months and here. We had about 845,000 people who traveled to Greece by boat from Turkey, and about 153,000 traveled mostly from Libya to Italy. However, there's sort of homogenizing narrative around the crisis also need to be a little bit of unpacking. And without going too much in details, one of the points we could raise is it one, two, or many crises here? What is in crisis is another issue that we should reflect on. But even just looking at the number and the profile of the arrivals, you can just see how different the two main routes were. So on one end, you have both in terms of the magnitude, the number of people that came, the countries of origin of the people that traveled, and age and gender, for example. So if you look, for example, at the pie chart, you can see first in terms of the size, is about five times bigger. You know, the arrivals in Greece in 2015 are five times bigger than one in Italy, as one end. If you look at the top five nationalities in the two countries, there is basically no overlap. So the top five countries in Greece were not the top five countries in Italy. And if you think just at the case of the Syrians in 2015, you have in Greece they were about 56% of the arrival. Over 500,000 people came to Greece from Syria. And in Italy they were about the 5%. So that you can see different. 5% of a much smaller number. But the other element which is interesting, apart from this difference in terms of country of origin, is also the significance of the others. While in a sense the flow into Greece is fairly homogeneous in the sense that you've got five larger groups that by themselves cover over 90% of arrival, and then you have 4% of others. If you look at the case, homogeneous in a sense it can be identified in clearly sort of trajectories from specific four or five countries. If you look at the case of Italy, you have about 41. You have 18 nationalities with more than 1% of arrival, and if you take off the first five countries, you've got over 40% of arrival which were qualified according to UNHCR data as others. What does it mean? That when you may be able to build a narrative about the crisis in Greece as mostly a refugee crisis from Syria. This is not the same story you can tell if you look at the case of Italy in 2015 and 16. So we need. So the point here is to understand and how you can reconcile these very different migration flows, refugee flows, in two different places and in one story around the refugee crisis. It's also interesting to observe that while in the case, if you look at the data on sea arrival, if you look at the case of Greece, you can clearly see that the 2015 is an exceptional year. So as you can see, it's the light gray. Have I got the pointer somewhere? Okay, is this one? Yeah. So this is arrival in Greece. You can see the peak. You can see, and you can also understand from the point of view of the asylum and migration regime, the capacity to reception of the country, that is a challenge. It's logistically a challenge. But if you look from the point of view of the case of Italy, you can see a completely different pattern there. It's actually the pace of the migration. It's a very, as been also pointed out by, for example, Ayn Haas, it's very cyclical. You can see basically it's the summer months from April until September, October that the numbers goes up and then go down. You certainly have had an increase since 2011 and with the Arab Springs. But in the way that we understand that this increase, it's actually important to look how we collect the data. So let's not just take the data as a given. In a sense, since 2011 in particular, the amount of resources and efforts being put in controlling the Mediterranean, in patrolling the Mediterranean, in counting people, is not comparable with before. One thing we observed in the course of the refugee crisis is also the fact that you have a very significant transformation of the way that the governance of irregular crossing in the central Mediterranean route has been managed. Just to give you an example, more or less since 2013, the so-called spontaneous arrival, the fact that a boat or a dinghy reach the shore of Italy, has disappeared. You know, no one of those 153,000 persons that arrived in 2015 or the 170,000 in 2014 reached Italy by themselves. This is all people that were intercepted at the sea. So as you can see, when it's a completely different logistics of the movement from Greece, where the most famous image is of the little boats that were coming on the shore of Lesbos, for example. So it's a different story there. How do we consider that? And this is a quote from an interview with an NGO worker in Rome, where he's pointing out how, yes, we had the Syrians, and it was mostly in 2014, but that was an exception. They disappeared soon after, and they don't even enter for the asylum system. And what we had is there is a continuity in the profile of the people that reached Italy over the years. So they're mostly the Western Africans and the Eastern Africans, and to a smaller extent, the North Africans, who have, in a sense, different routes as well. Okay, so let's move into the core of the presentation in terms of the topic of death and mourning. It's arguably, we could see that around the big tragedy at sea, that some important development in the policy making on the refugee crisis have happened. So in a sense, you could develop a chronology of the policy intervention and map it against the big accident. You will see that very often you had a major European summit following, after weeks, a major tragedy at sea. So this is just three key moments, in a sense, in the narrative of the refugee crisis that, in a sense, triggered action in terms of the policy response. You can see that, for example, what we call the European refugee crisis started with the Lampedusa tragedy at the beginning of October 2013, with over 300 people died just a few hundred meters from the coast of Lampedusa. As you can see in the photo, you have a very high-profile representation of Italian and European institutions at the official mourning for the episode. You have the Commissioner Cecilia Malmström. You have the Mayor of Lampedusa. You have Barroso, the EU Commissioner, and you have the then Italian Prime Minister, Enrico Letta, there. As a result of that episode in particular, Italy launched its largest search and rescue operation to date, which is the so-called Mare Nostrum operation, which in its official definition is a humanitarian and military operation, which in 12 months of operation saved about 153,000 people in 12 months alone. It was a costly operation with a significant display of use of resources and was led by the Italian Navy. A second tragic event, which had a significant impact on the development of the narrative of the refugee crisis, is happening in April 2015, when in about a week, 1,200 people died in a series of episodes. As a result of these events, what the European Union, that by that time had taken the leadership of the search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean, greatly enhanced its program of intervention, the so-called Triton Plus, which is led by Frontex, coordinated by Frontex, has got a hybrid mandate and very larger, and the resources that were put there were more or less the same than the one that were in the Mare Nostrum in projects. Following that that moment, there is a decline in the number of people that died at the sea. So the mortality rate went down after the Triton Plus was introduced. And finally, it's the third most dramatic episode is certainly the death of a 3-year-old Kurdish, Syrian Kurdish boy, Alan Kurdi, in August 2015. Here is the last photo of him alive that was you can find online. And as a result of that, of the tragic death and the outpouring of grief and sympathies all over the world and Europe in particular, and there has been studies looking at, for example, at the circulation of that image in Europe as one of the most circulated images in 2015, for example. What is being called the open policy for Syrians, the open door policy for Syrians by Germany started in. And a few months later, in October 2015, you have, in one month alone, about 200 people reached Greece from Turkey in one month alone to move towards northern Europe. However, so this point here, the point is that you got somehow a movement from death to public mourning to action. However, there is also there is also a pendulum there. There is also a return. And it's the way around, from action to death. And the point is that while, in a sense, the first series of responses qualified the European Union and the European states as looking themselves on a moral high ground, acting as a humanitarian actors and helping the poor migrants. If you look at a different series of episodes, you've got a different story there. So, for example, you could say that after the closure of Mare Nostrum, after 12 months, and the introduction of the Triton intervention, so the first version of Triton, you could see that in about 4 months, between January to April 2015, the number of people that died crossing the Mediterranean increased massively. So, for example, if you compare 4 months on Mare Nostrum, January to April 2014, January to April 2015, when the new Triton was in place, the death across the central Mediterranean went from 60 to 1,700. Okay? So in a sense, the kind of resources that were put in place, the kind of intervention that was put in place by the European Union at that point, could argue that has produced an increase in the number of people that died at sea. And this is easy to explain if you look in terms of the theater of operation of the boats during the Mare Nostrum operation, which is the red and orange area. And the cross indicates where the large majority of the largest tragedy happened. And the yellow one instead indicated the theater operation of the first Triton. So basically, they were not moving far away from the coast of Italy in terms of operation, so they were not able to reach boats when they were sinking. Just to give you an example. But there is also other policy that had a clearly an impact. For example, the so-called EU-Turkey deal, and including the involvement of the NATO somehow as advisor on the way that then the patrolling of the sea between the Turkey and Greece was carried out. The criminalization of NGOs, and the last big example was the series of events that forced, to an extent, MSF to leave the central Mediterranean and not carrying out any more search and rescue operation, but also the border externalization initiatives that have tried to limit the number of people that were reaching the coast, in a sense. And this is an important element that we will go back to later on in terms of what does it mean, proximity and distance, when we look at the official politics of mourning. Why we care only for people that died close to us, and not the one that died in the desert, if are the same policies that determine such episodes. Just to give you an example of the difference between Mare Nostrum and Triton in terms of the resources that were employed, the monthly budget of Mare Nostrum was about 9.5 million euros, and the monthly budget of Triton was 1.5 to 2.9 million. In terms of the boats that were sent, the vessels that were patrolling went from 4 to 1. There was no amphibious vessel involved. There was much less resources put into patrolling by sea and the use of drone, etc. So in a sense, you can really see that by decreasing massively, the resources that were put in place to do the search and rescue operation had an impact on the death at sea. And one interesting, sorry, I think I went a bit fast. If you look at this image here, it's from a research project carried out by Charles Eller and Lorenzo Pensani. It's part of their study around what is called forensic oceanography, and looks at how long it took to search a rescue vessel to reach an area of an accident. And you can observe, if you look over a long period of time, how the time it needed for an intervention increased. And that's it's a very important work in terms of determining what are the factors that may trigger more people to die at sea, as part of the understanding of how the governance of the regular crossing in the Mediterranean unfolded. Okay. So, as I said, if you think in terms of the migrant deaths at sea, we also, I mentioned before the 12,000 people that died in the last 3 years, but I think it's important to start to look at more closely about also this number in order to understand the way that the refugee crisis has worked and the governance of the refugee earthquake. So a very sort of basic starting point is to observe that in 2015, for example, if you look at the number of arrival, you have about 84% of the people that arrived by sea arrived in Greece, and 15% arrived in Italy. But if you look at the number of people that died crossing, you got exactly the opposite. So you have about 78% of the people that died at sea died at crossing from the central Mediterranean route between Libya and Italy, and about 20% crossing from Turkey to Greece. So the first sort of observation, very simple one, is that one route was much more dangerous than the other. And this is partly due to the fact that the mere distance you have to cross, it goes from 10 kilometers to 600 kilometers. With Lampedusa in the middle, around 300 kilometers from the coast. So there is a geographical explanation there. But I think we need to go beyond this, because if you observe instead, and this is what we try to do, at the variation in terms of death rates, by not just by route, but also over time, you see something also quite interesting. So in a sense, just to give you a sense, one person every 53 died crossing the central Mediterranean in 2015, one person every 1,049 crossing through the Eastern Mediterranean route. However, if you look at over time across the same route, one interesting element to observe is that in the first 3 months of 2016, so between January and March, suddenly the death rates in the crossing between Turkey and Greece went up significantly. So it's no longer one person in 1,000, but now it's one person every 500 that die. So what's going on? It's the same route, the same 10-kilometer distance. This is interesting, because then after March, what happened is the implementation of the EU-Turkey deal and basically the closure of the route altogether. So before the closure, you have a significant increase of the people that died at sea. What was happening there is that basically the implementation of the EU-Turkey deal had started before. Despite we normally say that it started in March, in reality it had started a month before. And it started by a much more proactive and involvement of the Turkish coastal guards, a much stronger control over the territory in Turkey, but also which had forced, in many ways, they were up until then fairly safe crossing with the daylight to become night crossing, no longer towards easy part of the coast, but towards more rocky areas. In some cases, there is some evidence that people started not to use any more orange, flashy sort of life jackets because they didn't want to be intercepted by the coastal guard, and they started to use black ones, so they become invisible at night crossing, so the crossing became much more dangerous as a result of this shift in the way that the policing of the border of Europe was carried out. If we look instead from the point of view of the central Mediterranean route, you can observe also a variation in terms of the mortality rate over the 2014, 15, and 16, which is quite significant. I have selected only the January to May period for a number of reasons, partly if it's better with the change in terms of the policy in place in search and rescue operation, in the sense when the policy started and finished. But also there is another important element, that normally in the summer months, the NGOs boat go at sea. So it's when MOAS or when MSF send their boat at sea. And you can really see a change in the death rate in terms of dropping when there is NGOs involved. So if you look at the winter month is when the search and rescue operation is mostly run by EU Frontex state-led vessels. And what you can see is that comparing Mare Nostrum with Triton, you have a significant increase from 0.94% to 3.75% in terms of death rate. It went up again in 2016 with a much stronger, when the so-called war on traffickers and human smugglers sort of got traction, so in a sense with the Sofia operation in place. So in a sense, if we think again to those three sort of crucial sort of events in terms of episode that produced hundreds of people to die in most cases, what was actually characterizing them? Because it may help us to start to understand what was different, why those events became so significant, but also why it's clearly possible to identify a sort of not all dead bodies count in the same way. So if you think about the Lampedusa episode, it is the larger number of people that died. Second element is the proximity to the Europe shore, so the fact that there was a few hundred meters from the coast. But there is also a new pope that just a few months before took office, if you can say took office about the pope, and he made actually his first international visit to Lampedusa just a few weeks before. So he went there and sort of talked about the duty of care towards the migrants, etc. Also, that is quite important, is that Italy had just recently changed the prime minister, and the person that took office was a non-elected, was a so-called technocrat, so expert, a person that was member of the central, the Catholic, the Democratic Party from the Catholic side of it, but also was someone who had not to go for an election to get to the post, which is actually a very important aspect in the sense of the way you handle the pressure coming from arrivals. The second episode, the April 2015, is particularly important because of the sheer size. We're talking about in a week over 1,200 people that died. So it's unprecedented in the sense of the concentration of episodes in a week alone. But it comes to a very specific time because at that time, countries like particularly the United Kingdom had pushed very strongly for a downsizing of the search and rescue operation. So partly the fact why Triton has got so much less resources than Mare Nostrum was because countries like the UK, and there is a very good statements in the Parliament about it that I always use when I write articles about it, that we say that basically the search and rescue operation was a pull factor, and so we need to decrease the presence because more people will jump in the sea and try to die so they get rescued, essentially. So the fact that it was such a huge number of people that died, in a sense, on one end, triggered a change of position by the British government, although that was quite a tactical thing. They had an election a few weeks after, so in a sense they wanted to look a bit more sympathetic, in a sense. But also was important because the civil society, the private actor, played a major role in terms of making those people visible. And then there was major intervention, for example, from Amnesty International doing a number of intervention in public squares using the life jacket as a way of sort of bringing the crisis at the core of Europe, not just at this southern border. The third one, the Alan Kurdi episode, and it's important because for the first time, rather than the masses, what we look at, what we care about is a single photo. It's not a mass episode, and in a sense, you have had hundreds of children who have died in the crossing, but that's the only one face that we know. But partly, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about the fact that the kids was white, Western-looking. He was coming from Syria, and so in a sense was falling within the category of the deserving refugees within the European narrative. There is an aspect that we also have to think about in terms of how the different logistic of the migration routes also affect the kind of tragedies that happen. If you think about, so the first boat here, this one, is a boat crossing from Libya to Italy. The second one is a boat crossing from Turkey to Greece. So in a sense, the size of the boat determines also the size of the tragedy. If there is a boat with hundreds of people in it, if there is an accident, that means that there is a major number of loss of life. In the other case, you have a smaller number. So when there is an episode of an accident, it's easier to do a rescue operation because it's much logistically easier, but it also creates less attention in most cases. So, sorry for the photo. Should have warned you. So what the point I wanted to make here is that, in a sense, what we saw here is that there is, within the narrative of the refugee and migration crisis, by now we start to use both terms more, so that we have lost the battle on the refugee only, and then migration start to come back much stronger at this point. There is a difference between who are the deserving, the people deserving to be helped, and the one they are not. So in a sense, if you compare what I said before about the children that died, let's see, this is a young girl that died near the coast of Libya, more or less in April 2015. But this photo, you haven't seen it, because actually was considered too shocking, while the other one was not. So it's quite interesting how you choose which is shocking or more shocking. But also, I think it's important what Judy Butler said, that in a sense, the way that we constitute our sense of responsibility, the boundaries of our politics of mourning define who we are. So not only in the sense of who are we, who we decide to mourn, but also the one that we are not. So in a sense, it's very important to observe what are the line of exclusion in terms of who we think is deserving of this, of the public mourning, and why. So how do we explain this ambiguity? In particular, I think it's important to observe the fact that we seem to care only about the people that died very close to us rather than the one that died. Despite the fact that they're the same migrants or the same refugees along the same route, but only when this episode happened very close to the coast, very close to the border of Europe, with the sense, a sense of responsibility is felt in terms of the policymaker. And there is plenty of research that shows that, in a sense, the way that particularly the European border operates with the process of externalization is pushing more and more immigration controls outside the territory of Europe. And you can see as a strategy it works fairly well in terms of, in a sense, of distancing the deaths and distancing the responsibility. In the Rhys Jones, in his book Violent Border, very much characterized the migrants have not as an exception in the way that the border operates, but actually as the product of this particular policy of bordering that been put in place. And Ruben Anderson has talked about the commodification of migrant bodies, and sort of the bioeconomy of the crisis, both in terms of the migrant bodies that are alive, but also the ones that are dead. And work by Bembe, in a sense, around the necropolitics is very much an important point of reference in trying to understand what's going on here in terms of how the European border is constructed both by the display of humanity but also by the capacity to exercise and control and differentiate who is allowed to live or die in an attempt to cross into the border. And while the general talks about the border spectacles and in a sense of a sort of a schizophrenic border spectacle, I think you can find a lodging into it. It's not schizophrenia at all there. It's actually clear there is a rationalization of the migrant bodies, so in a sense of which one is deserving, which is underserving, and there is also clearly this idea that the construction of responsibility is very much linked to the distance from the core of the European states, and the importance of media, the construction of this narrative of who we cry for is actually extremely important. Within this process, what is interesting is to observe as how the imperative to save humans that very soon became known with an hashtag, you know, save humans, it has been resignified in the process. So save humans at some point meant that we need to put all the boats at sea and take the people out from the sea. But gradually what we observed is two things. Became a justification for the closure of the Turkey-Greek border. So one of the justifications for the introduction of the EU-Turkey deal, if you look at the statement by the various commissioners, is that by doing it, we are saving people from dying at the hand of the human traffickers. They're very good. So we save them by not allowing them to migrate. If you look at it from the other perspective is, once the border was closed, so once the Syrians were not allowed anymore to come in, and the deserving refugees were not longer coming, the narrative about the regular crossing changed dramatically, and it became back to be the illegals try to cross into Europe. There was the word refugees disappeared almost in the public discourse and the political discourse, and very much the story there is we need to help them at home, which is a very sort of famous trope in a sense in migration policy lingo. So in a sense it became like we have to save migrants from migrating in a sense. We save them by immobilizing in Africa, for example. This is very much where the policy is moving in terms of the going back to the bilateral agreement to work closely with development, using development aid to increase border checks, making the borders between African states much more solid than they were, and et cetera, et cetera. So if we go back to the title, Stop This Carnage, that was a quote from Matteo Renzi in an article in New York Times in April 2015. So again, around those week we're talking about. So the full statement is this. The Mediterranean Sea, cradle of our civilization, is becoming a deathbed for thousands of nameless, desperate men, women, and children. These people had lives full of pain, despair, and hope, which led them to become victims of human trafficking. The voices of mothers who've lost their children at sea will haunt our conscience. We must stop this carnage. Okay? So this carnage, what I want to point out, is how it's much more qualified what's the carnage we need to stop in the statement. It's very clear, first of all, I mean, all the points that I put in bold, our civilization. So in a sense, it's actually claiming that the space of the Mediterranean is European. So in a sense, it's claiming the responsibility on that space. This is partly how we are feeling responsible if we mourn the people that die at sea. Second aspect is blaming the human traffickers. So this is all about human trafficking. We have no responsibility in terms of determining the border policy that push people towards the human traffickers. It's the traffickers, the one that we have to fight on. The third aspect is he only cares about the mother that cried for the people that died at sea. If they're dead in the land, in the desert, they don't care. He doesn't care about it. So it's quite an important way of qualifying, and it really sort of, in a way, is revealing of an approach and the link between the policy intervention and the politics, the official politics of mourning the refugee crisis. So as a way to bring another dimension to this, I've looked into the Simon McManaman, myself, my colleague Simon, we're looking into the way that the migrants we interviewed for the project were articulating their experiences of death during the journey. One first aspect that came out, emerged, was that out of the 500 people we interviewed, about 20% had witnessed or death during the journey. This means, in most cases, about over 65%, up 60 to 65% was direct experience. So someone was traveling with you, they died. And the others were from sort of indirect experience that someone told me that someone else had died during the journey. So that's one element which is... So the experience of death is actually very important among the people we interviewed. The second point here is that, interestingly enough, the very large majority of these experiences are not at sea, but are on land. So people very much, and this is actually, I should say, obviously there is a methodological bias here, because in most cases, especially for people that came from the central Mediterranean, if they had experienced a direct experience of death at sea, probably they were on the boat, so in a sense they were saved. Statistically, it was more likely they were not among the people we interviewed. But nonetheless, it's still telling us how important and significant is the experience of the violence which is linked to the journey on land, in Africa in particular. The third aspect is that one route was much more dangerous and violent than the other. So the central Mediterranean route, which culminated in Libya and then cross, it's by far much more dangerous than the Eastern Mediterranean one. And in particular is Western Africans, young men, that are the ones that experience by far violence and have seen death very close as part of their experience. So as you can see here, in terms of the region of origin of the people we interviewed, is very much mostly the Western and Central Africans that tell about this experience. Partly you can relate this to the length of the journey. So if you look at the report, we basically very much count how long it took for people to reach into Italy or Greece, and we explore the very much definition of journey by questioning, in a sense, the definition of journey by revealing how, in many cases, multiple journeys that are in part of a migration trajectory, not a single one. But nonetheless, if someone has taken 2 years to get into Italy, it's more likely that to have experienced violence along the way. But the point that I think is important to make is that this experience of death are formative and transformative experiences in the narrative that migrants build about their experiences of migration itself, but also how they understand their decision-making process, in a way shapes the way that migration happens. So in many cases, death, rather than become a reason not to move, was actually the reason for moving, especially when it was death, experience of death and violence on land. There is also some important practical implication in many cases, like the loss of social network and resources. If a friend dies during the journey, you may lose all your knowledge about where to go, and so you can change the trajectory you're taking. But also in terms of the motivation. So a 29-year-old Gambian man that we interviewed in Italy said everyone was armed, even children. I couldn't remain there. He's talking about Libya. It was too dangerous. Another Ghanaian man said, either I will die or I will live. I survive and live and stay and die. I give everything to God. So there is also this sense of, I've seen what I've seen, so now the journey at sea, and this is what is important, is only one part of a longer trajectory where there has already been experience of death. So this, when we think about, if we let people know how dangerous is the crossing, they will not cross. It doesn't really work necessarily if you have already known about death all the way through, the violence, you have been kidnapped, etc., etc. So in a sense, the significance of the risk of dying at sea has to be located in a broader narrative about risks that are associated with migration in the circumstances across the, along the central Mediterranean route, for example. And in the case, for example, of the eastern Mediterranean route, is even more interesting because that route is much less violent and much less and the experience of direct violence are many less. So in a sense, there is a much more gap, a larger gap between those experiences and the narrative coming from Europe that said we need to close the route because it's so dangerous for you. So I think this quote in a way encapsulates what I'm trying to say. And this is an Ethiopian woman of 22. So just think about how the age is. We were very afraid on the boat. We could die. But at that point, if you have lived the terrible things I saw in Libya and other countries, you do not care anymore about dying. It's almost better to die. If we arrive, okay. If it's okay if I die, whatever God wants. So this sense of inevitability, in a sense, but also about relating the risk of the sea with the previous story, something that is very rarely made in the public discourse on the migration and crossing. So just to conclude, death and rescue are central to the politics of migration as is unfolded in the Mediterranean, in particular since 2013. The public mourning drove became a key factor in the reorganization of the governance of migration. And I mentioned the fact that spontaneous arrival disappeared and people were just taken out and brought on land in most cases, especially if we think at the central Mediterranean. What is important to bear in mind is also that not all deaths are mourned equally. And the politics, for example, focus on sea crossing, on the sea crossing, on eastern route, and on Syrians. While the data that we found in the project highlights how it's mostly young African men crossing along the central Mediterranean route that witness death on land. So it's basically just almost antithetic in terms of the significance of death, how it's constructed in the policy and in the experiences. Death can shape the experience and motivate people to move rather than deterring them. The risk of the journey versus the certainty of death without moving. And after long journeys in which death has been a repeated experience, many people consider themselves already dead before boarding the boats. Thank you.